Well, yeah, it was kind of.
All right. So we are in our last lesson of Lamentations. So, you know, I struggle with, do I want to finish Lamentations? Do I want to go back? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give us a good overview of 4 and 5. And if we have time, I'll go back to 3 and explain a little more. My guess is we won't. Therefore, on your last page is my a little bit more intricate detail about 3 and Jeremiah's example. And I gave you most of my notes there so that I don't think we'll get to page 3. Or yeah, I think that's your page 3. So I just wanted you to be able to have that so that as we're talking about what Jeremiah's been doing, you'll have at least a little idea of his example of really how he shows himself to them and how he gets them to move. So the purpose of Lamentations, the purpose of lament, is not to just stay in lament, but it's actually meant to move you somewhere. And Lamentations itself, the book of Lamentations, actually is trying to correct a paradigm that seeks to fix the world's disorder through a solo human effort, through human effort to be able to fix disorder. And Lamentations is trying to correct that paradigm, because that's what Israel has been living under the assumption of. It's what we have been living under the assumption of. It's why we have the results of an election. No matter what happened with the election last night, both results would have been the same. We, as a nation, are trying to fix the disorder that is going on through our effort. And through in politics, we often go toward, if we just get enough power, and if we just get enough power in the right individual, that's how we will be able to fix disorder. It's the whole purpose of our elections, because that's what we're based on, right? We're very based on this material ontology that says we can fix it because it's about us being the center. The problem is it doesn't just happen in the political world. It also happens in the church world, right? It happens within the body of believers. And it's always happened there, but in the church world, I mean, we go through the same thing, right? We look for leaders in the church who are who have a lot of power, right? And power in the church world is charismatic, big churches, you know, all of this kind of, we have power in the political realm through the church world, whatever. But it underlying all that, since the 19th century, we've kind of switched what New Testament was telling us. We kind of switched even what the reformers were affirming from the New Testament. And we've said, and this is, I mean, you look at all the literature and you'll see this happening. And I'm almost ashamed to say that much of it happened through the Baptist type churches. Mm-hmm. That we began to say, and we began to believe in the priesthood of the believer. Now, that's interesting, right? Because you're thinking, well, wait. Isn't that true? But the reformers didn't say the priesthood of the believer. Do you know what the reformers said? Priesthood of all believers. And there's a huge, huge difference there. Mm-hmm. So it was in the 19th century movements of all the churches, particularly it was happening in England, and then it was being brought over to America, that it was the priesthood of the believer. So I'll read you just a couple of quotes that I think were exactly talking about what that means. Instead of talking about the priesthood of the believer, the reformers spoke instead of the priesthood of all believers. For them, it was never a matter of a lonely, isolated seeker of truth, but rather of a band of faithful believers united in a common confession as a local, visible, it's Latin, holy congregation. We have lost that. We've absolutely lost that. We in America, in our Christian culture, it is all about me going to God. It's all about me going. And when I contradict that with people, they look at me like I'm nuts. Right? When I say, well, there's no such thing about a relationship with you and God. And they look at me like I'm nuts. So much so that I know that that is how ingrained we have become to believe that it is a priesthood of the believer. Never has been, never will be. I love this quote from Luther. Luther said, the priesthood of all believers does not mean I am my own priest. It meant rather, in the community of saints, God has so tempered the body that we are all priests to each other. I mean, right? That's what Luther says. I mean, so obviously there was a problem even then. And we've talked about this. I mean, part of the idea of the printing press actually affirmed the priesthood of the believer rather than of all believers being priests to each other. And with that, he said, we had a commission that sends us forth into the world to exercise a priestly ministry, not for ourselves, but for others. So we look at that, and we wonder about the election, the whole year process that's happened and where we're going. And I remember I said, this is a symptom of the church's disorder, not the nation's disorder. That's a symptom of the church's disorder. And the church's disorder is that we have become a priest to ourselves. We've become our own priests. And that's not ever what God has won for us. He's won back for us the priesthood toward one another, the perichoretic life. So Lamentations is actually trying to correct that. So it's not a new thing that's happened, but it keeps happening over and over again. So what's happening, what we're beginning to see in the book of Lamentations is that an honest lament about our own disorder is part of the process of dealing with the consequences of disorder, of our own self-centered lives, of how we decide to go. And Israel in Lamentations is in great pain. We know that. And they're feeling the loss of life as they knew it. And here's a funny thing. So I have this written in my Bible. Feeling the loss of life as they knew it. And I almost have to look at this again. I wrote it down. Where did I put this? I wrote it down that says, just like today. I didn't write this year. Like what we are experiencing in 2009. Mm-hmm. That's what I wrote in there. And I go, 2009? What was happening in 2009? I have no idea. Because I think it's so pertinent for absolutely this day. Right? 2016. Interesting. So we're what that tells me is we've been moving along and we don't even recognize it anymore. Like we didn't realize that we're moving toward exactly where Israel has been moving.
Isn't that when Obama took over in 2009?
Could be, but I definitely would not have put that. That would not have been my reason there.
But before
9, 10, 11, 12, 13. No, he would no.
It was 8.
It was 8. Yeah. 18. I don't know. I don't know what it was. But interesting that, kind of like the frog in the pan, right? We get used to disorder, and pretty soon, and I kind of heard last night some people talking like, you know, don't worry, everything will be okay. And I want to say, peace, peace. Like, no, mm-hmm. We're not supposed to say that. We're supposed to, well, I'll talk about it. Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you need help?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, but your earring is going to a little bit.
Karen, you need to fix it. Okay. So maybe I probably should take the scarf off.
Oh, no.
Entrapment, yes.
Nothing like disorder.
I don't know what
you're
doing. Can I take your earring out?
Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry. I didn't want to pull on your earring. I don't know what you did.
Okay, how about this?
Let's take out the earrings.
Yeah. I'll work on it.
Oh, now it's on my neck. Okay, obviously, this is...
This I got.
Thank you. Okay. Sorry for the interruption there. So Israel is suffering the loss of life as they knew it, right? But we as observers, we stand back and go, good thing. Because they were destroying themselves. We'll see that even more clearly today. The loss and suffering propel them to cry out, right? They're finally in that place where we're crying out, which I hope this morning, and from the text I was getting this morning, I think at least some of the church is crying out, like, what is happening? And all I could think of, I know I've recommended this movie before, hard movie, Terrence Malick, who does great movies, it's called Dogville. You remember this one? It talks about what happens when the church stops receiving and giving grace. I mean, it is just, you won't know that unless you watch it very carefully. Thank you, Donna.
Oh, you're welcome.
But their pain causes Israel to cry out, not only to express their pain, but also to declare, we don't want to be in this place, and we don't want to stay in this place of pain. So there's a desire to move. They just don't know how to move there. What is it that is going to get them to move out of that place? They don't want to stay there. Nobody wants to stay in a place of pain and suffering and torment. Interesting, though, we've talked so much about our functional identity, remembering that everything that we have materially, including our emotions, which is what's really being on highlighted here in Lamentations, is given for the purpose of us being able to function, right? So emotion, this is a really interesting thing. Emotions, the Latin word for emotions actually means to move or to be moved. So that the purpose of our emotions is actually to make us move. We're to feel our emotions so that we move, so that we get moved from one place to another. But as always, we can go in two different directions, right? We can either go toward life, where God is the center of order, or we can go toward our own self-centered addictions, right? Those, remember the whole time we had the candles moving toward the big screen and all the technology and material wealth and power. We have that moving there. We can go that way too. Emotion can make us go that way too. Suffering can make us go deeper into addictions. But when God brings us suffering, and I know you struggle with that, but God brings us suffering. And by the way, the Jewish community has no problem with saying God brings suffering. Absolutely no problem. It's only when we get into Greek life, into the New Testament, that people are skittish about that. But God brings the suffering in order to make us feel so that we move toward Him. He wants us to feel that, which is interesting. And we mostly say, no, that can't be, until you say, I'm a parent and my child is in trouble and you will hurt him in order that he not get killed, right? You will do that. You will do anything for that, which is the whole point of God bringing suffering, so that we are moved toward him and toward him so that he can engage with us without obstacle. Because the obstacle is all the stuff we're moving toward on the other way, and he's trying to get that out of our sight so that we can engage with him. But left on our own, we will always move toward ourselves, toward our own order, toward our own addictions, always. We will always do that, which is why joining in lament is so important. When we ignore someone else's pain, or we hide our own pain, in reality what we're doing is resisting God's gravitational pull toward himself and his pericritic life. So that when we ignore someone else's pain or we hide our own pain, we are resisting God's gravitational pull toward himself and pericritic life. I think that's really important for us to understand, because again, we have become a church that is a praise-only church. And we ignore and hide and try to get rid of quickly the pain. And we lose all of that pericritic pull that God is trying to bring to us through the pain. It's in the sharing of our pain, when broken meets broken, that we actually begin to invoke our priestly tasks, that we actually begin to say, hey, I can come alongside of you. It's when we incarnate, when we fleshly make our witness with someone else instead of handing them that sandwich. I almost wanted to make us redraw the cartoon as it goes farther, because it does go farther than what we've seen. When we incarnate our own witness, our own brokenness with others, we give each other the courage to move. We give each other to say, we're all needing to move toward that place. When I don't incarnate my brokenness with somebody else, I say, here, I'm whole. Why don't you go move over there? It's this, I'm going to direct you. I'm going to give you some direction rather than I'm coming with. And we're going to do something so that you see that a little more clearly. But when we go with someone in our own brokenness, we actually give one another the courage to move the other way. And we go moving the other way toward a hope that our value will be reinstalled, that our worth will be seen again, which is why we're in this suffering. And we'll begin to see that what we've lost is not so much the material life as we knew it, but what we've lost is that perichoretic union with God and with one another. And really, that is my prayer. This morning, that was my prayer. It's like, may we as the church see what we've lost here. It is not our way of life, or it's not that we're protecting our way of life. God forbid that that's what happens here today, that we as the church say, oh, good, now we're good. Now President Trump will keep us safe. God forbid that we ever think that. May we understand, may we be completely exposed. I do feel we're in a place where we say, God, whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That we might become the people who are broken,
right,
and we give ourselves to the world. Joining in lament is so important, and I think it's one of the great losses of the church and why the church has been so ineffectual. Mm-hmm. We haven't met the world where they're at. Mm-hmm. Because we say, we're here up above that pit. Mm-hmm. You guys come up here. Instead of coming down to that pit and saying, yeah, we're just like you. We're all in this together. We're very broken as well.
Just that video, I showed it to my high school leaders of wildlife students, the empathy and sympathy. And for the first time, they were like, oh my gosh. This is what empathy is. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so as a little bit of an encouragement,
yes,
some high school students are understanding, I think, what it means to actually be empathetic.
Yay. Yes.
And that, like, we have to connect with something in ourselves to connect with others.
Yes.
So that was really exciting for me.
Yes.
To see
exciting.
A high school kid go, oh, this is what empathy is.
Yes.
And this is, like, what it means to connect with someone and, like, be vulnerable in the midst of that.
Yeah.
And lament, essentially. Like,
right.
So, just a little
good.
Encouragement.
That's
that,
very
that video
cool.
Is,
that's cool.
And what we were talking about is affecting
Yay.
High school kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And creating change.
Yeah. That's a really good thing. And I do think that's where we are in the nation, as a church. We have. So one of the first texts I got this morning was, you know, what has happened in our nation, and I said, well, God has given us what we've been clamoring for, and she said, but the ones who will affect the this will affect the most are the oppressed. It was my daughter. She worked with refugees, and she's like, no, I know who's going to feel this the most. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where we need to be as a church.
Mm-hmm.
And even thinking about that, I just think we're so about protecting ourselves. Mm-hmm. We need to be broke. The church needs to be broken, completely broken, so that we can meet there with them, because it's the priest's task in the midst of brokenness. It's the priest's task to be the first to move toward the presence of God in their own brokenness. It's not the priest's task to stand above that pit and say, you're all broken, I know how to fix you, come up and eat my sandwich. That's not the priest's task. The priest's task is to first, remember, we learned this in Leviticus, priest always goes first, right? The priest goes across the Jordan first. So that was that Remember, they are the ones who have to actually step into this water that's rushing. It's during spring flood time, and it's rushing, and the priest is the one who has to go first, who has to take the risk to say, I'm vulnerable, I'm broken, and I'm going to go to the presence of God. I have to be vulnerable to do that, and I can't do that in the nice, safe place of my little home, my own little devotions, my own little church, because what good is it going to do for me to go first if no one knows? So the priest has to go first publicly, going out there saying, we're broken. We're so broken that this is what we have come to. And we want to go to God. And in that brokenness, to invite others to come with us. So do you see the difference in staying up above the pit and saying, you're broken, you need to come up here where we're all whole? As opposed to, I am broken, and could you guys come with me? Think about the difference that is. That's a huge difference.
But I'm afraid.
Right, I am afraid.
But we're not all whole either.
None of us are whole.
This is not a problem.
None of us are whole.
That's right. None of us are whole. So to say, yeah. If we're whole up here, come on up.
Right,
this is ridiculous.
Yes. So I want us to think about, and we've talked a lot about this metaphor about being at the wedding table, right? And we're passing, so we're emptying and passing. We're emptying and passing. So we're actually going to do that. We're actually going to empty and pass, which is what you smell today. I'll have to think of when I got this out. Did you remember last time we used this and I had
eggs.
These didn't stay warm like the warm eggs. So I want you to, I just want you to take out one of each. This is your life. So you each are one little roll of bread here. So take one, and I'll pass places just so you have that on the plate. What we're going to do is in theory, is in metaphor, what Jeremiah has done for Israel in his own modeling. So as each of you take one, and you, this is your life, what you're to share. But I'm going to choose a couple of you to actually be vulnerable and be not a whole piece, but a broken piece. So Michelle, I'm going to choose you. You're going to be a broken piece. So I would like you to break your thing and just keep it there broken. Edie, would you be broken? When you get your piece, would you just break your piece?
Sure.
And put it with you? Karen, would you be a broken piece? Yep. Yeah. There's just two Karens today. three Karens. One, two, three. Okay, so we're missing two. Donna, would you be a broken piece? Okay. So I want us to think about this. So as we're at the wedding table and we're passing along the plates, and we're giving ourselves to one another, right? We're emptying ourselves. We're putting it on this platter so that the person next to me can actually have. And I'm going to, just because at a wedding you don't just have one plate going around, right? Make sure it gets all the way to the back.
So
this is what we're going to do. If we as priests are supposed to be sharing our lives with one another, right? Being vulnerable with one another, we're going to give our life on the platter so that the next person can have our life, okay? And then we'll be empty, and so we'll have to receive the platter from somebody else that has somebody else's life on it, and we're going to take their life. Does that make sense to you? And I'll explain what's happening here as we do that. All right, so I want you to take your loaf. And I want the plates to be passed, and I want you to put your life on there, give it to somebody else, and then wait for someone to give you their life, okay? So wherever the things are going.
So do I do both pieces if I'm broken?
Well, you have to decide that.
Okay. So we're passing our life here.
Yeah, but you also be taking a life.
Oh, I wasn't offered a life.
Okay.
I've been offered three lives.
So it's a little bit hard because we're not in a circle. But just make sure that when one comes to you, you take a life. If there's a life there, you receive somebody else's life. And I'll pass it down. Pass it around. So actually, we're going. So bring it this way. Yeah, there you go. Has it gone to the back?
Are we talking about this? Are we going to talk about our experience?
Yeah, here.
Okay. Are we all good?
Has everyone received a life?
I gave her my life that I got back.
And you don't have a, so somebody has two lives?
It's at the back.
Oh, okay.
Because so we started coming. Out with there the empty tray.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
I think
here you go. Here it is. It's coming.
Right there it is.
Yeah, it's a broken one.
Okay, so Karen, ended up with a broken life, right? So, first of all, when we're giving each other our lives, this is what we normally do, right? We give them the very whole life, the life that looks polished, right, and good, and everyone's pretty good with you know, taking. What happens when we do that? It really becomes a transaction, right? Mm-hmm. I'm getting a life. For a life. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is, those of you who are broken, I watched, and some of you are like, now what do? I have a broken life.
Yeah.
Don't want to know, do I give? What happens in real life is, if we're all passing our whole lives around, I'm doing this for you, you're doing this for me, what happens in reality? And I want to ask you and Karen, what happened to you, what were you thinking about when everyone was passing their whole lives and you had a broken life to give?
I felt really awkward taking the whole life. Really awkward.
Yes, exactly.
So I almost ripped it in half.
Yes, exactly.
That's why I said, are we going to talk about this?
Right.
Because I literally welled up with tears and thought, do I break it or do I keep it?
Yep. Most of the time, you have a broken life and everyone's giving their whole lives, their shiny lives, their lives like, well, and I'm always afraid that I would ever come across with saying, you know, oh, I do Sabbath really well. You know, why don't you guys do Sabbath really well? Oh. I do remember saying things like that in front of class years ago, and I had to go in front of class and repent. Like, oh, my gosh. What happens with the broken people is, like, they don't feel like they can be a part of that. Mm-hmm. They can't receive a whole life if all they have to give is a broken life. Mm-hmm. So when I'm giving my whole life, I am actually causing those who have broken lives, who obviously know they have broken lives, they can't hide it, to go away. I'm also causing those people who have broken lives, I was hoping to see somebody with the broken lives, trying to, like,
put it back together.
Yeah. Because that's really what we do.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, we like, in fact, I don't know if you remember this. Boy, I don't know how many years ago. Years ago, we did almost a similar thing, but we broke pots. Or we had to decorate pots, and we broke them. And somebody came with them back. Do you remember this? And somebody came having glued her pieces back together.
I never broke mine.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So that's what. So when we share our really polished, nice lives, we eliminate the people whose lives are so broken that they can't hide it. But we also cause everybody else to hide their brokenness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that in reality, we're not even sharing our real lives, right? We're sharing a false life. Okay. And therefore, we're actually not pouring out as God does. We're not giving out as priests do. So this idea of us, and all of us struggle with this. There isn't one of us that don't struggle with this. We want to be whole. And we don't want people to really know all of our broken stuff. But there is actual beauty in sharing the broken. You see, it looks nice as we all sit here. Most of us sit here still with these whole things. That looks really nice. But in reality, there's no growth that happened, right? Nothing happened. It's status quo. We all end up with one life. There's nothing that's happened.
Does it ever become a one-upsman? You tell me your story, or tell us your story, and we say, oh, how horrible. But I got one that beats that. You know.
Why would that happen?
Self.
Right. So that now that becomes a, but in true lament, in true pain, no one wants to up someone else in true pain.
Yeah.
No one. So I'm gonna tell you an example, and then we're gonna do this again in a different way. So how does a human life grow? Physiologically, how does a human life grow? How does it start and how does it grow?
Cells divide.
Cells divide. Mm-hmm. It starts with one cell, it divides itself. And it divides itself over and over and over again. That's how growth happens. Breaking, 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 breaking. Now I want you to think about all the ways you yourself are broken. And when I talk about broken, what I mean is every time you think about an addiction you have, a place that you go to when you're feeling bad or good, a place that you really don't want to give up, some kind of order for yourself that you don't want to give up, that you want to control. So, you have ideas?
No, we're left. But yes, I do.
Yeah. So, yeah. Every time I think about an addiction, like when I'm stressed, I will immediately go to sugar. Mm-hmm. I like to have everything in order, literally in order. It makes me feel calm, like I have some control. Mm-hmm. So that's what the kind of things, your identity. I want to be a straight A student. That's an addiction. Every time you think of one of your disorders, I want you to just break yourself, okay? And put it on your plate and just break yourself. However many times it takes. And I will be as bold to say, if I see one of you having only two pieces,
you're going to come and break our bread?
I'm going to question you. Because there isn't one of us. First of all, none of us are whole. And second of all, none of us are even half. So I want you to be honest with yourself. Nobody's going to know what the broken pieces are. You will know. So my desire actually was that it would be really messy. I was hoping that's why I kind of... Because you know what? Your messes come out just nice, right? So this time, we're going to do the exact same thing. We're passing the plate around. And you can share your broken life with everybody. So I will start. And I'm going to pour myself out. And remember that you are going to take broken life. And you can choose whatever broken life you want to take, however much you want. But you do have to pour your whole self out.
It'd be really interesting if a lot of us poured, because then you wouldn't know whose was whose. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, look. One set of those to go.
So be honest with yourself as you're taking broken life. How much broken life will you receive? I want you to be really honest about this.
Probably not as much as we think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, probably
yeah.
Like
one. Yeah. So,
I honestly didn't think about not taking it all. I'm probably more honest.
Yeah, so to be honest, you probably wouldn't take everybody's, you wouldn't take all the brokenness. Whatever Karen hands to me, I probably wouldn't take it all.
Right.
For one, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. And for two, I kind of know my own limitations, right? Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
I know that I won't be able to handle
all
that.
Aren't you taking someone complete brokenness from somebody is almost a savior complex than where you feel.
Exactly.
Like
yep. Yep.
That's why I left them for you.
You're welcome, Linda.
Yeah.
here's an interesting thing. And first of all, I want you to think of anything else that you know in the New Testament that looked like this.
Broken body. Here's my broken body.
Yeah, think before that.
Loaves
and fishes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What happens when we share our brokenness, and that's exactly what's happening in the loaves and fishes. Everybody came there completely. So if I was teaching this, I would tell you all the background story of it. But everyone was coming there, and they were basically going, like, we're totally broken. And Jesus was saying, me too. I'm with you too. But look what happens. We have leftovers. All of a sudden, there's growth, right? We have leftovers. It is no longer status quo, right? We've all been fed. You can eat that if you want. But there's been growth because of brokenness, which is antithetical to our paradigms, right? Mm-hmm. We don't think brokenness brings growth. Mm, yeah. And yet it was through Christ's brokenness that brings life. It is always through brokenness that brings life. It's through death that life comes. Every cycle of nature, everything that God has put into us tells us that that's what happens. And yet we fight that. Mm-hmm. We absolutely fight. I don't want to be broken. I don't want to feel the pain. But then we think, wait, but to feel the pain means to move me. And yet, I won't move myself, but I will move with others. So that's kind of the whole trajectory of Lamentations and what Jeremiah is doing as he's identifying himself, as he's moving slowly toward Israel, but then he keeps moving toward God and invites them to move toward God with him. So that when he says, I know the place to go, he's not doing it from a place of being apart. He's not saying, I've got the answer for you. He's going, I don't have an answer. Would you come with me and we can come to God together? It's a whole different paradigm that Jeremiah does. I actually think, so obviously we don't have anything in Lamentation that says Jeremiah wrote it. Most scholars think Jeremiah wrote it. But I actually think there's a purpose in that. Because I think he wants us to know all of us are this way. We're all broken. He doesn't want, I think if we absolutely knew Jeremiah wrote it, we'd go, well, Jeremiah didn't sin. I mean, he suffered because of other people's sin. Yep. But Jeremiah says, no, I sin too. I'm part of this too. Moses does the same thing, right? I mean, we see this throughout Scripture. But I think that's a purposeful, all of us are in this position of standing away, being objective observers. And I think that's where we are today. We can stand and look at this election and say, either, well, I didn't vote for Trump, or I'm not part of the mess that we came here. Or we can say, as the church, no, this is us. We're broken here. This is what we have gravitated toward so much. This is who we are. And in our brokenness, we'll be able to meet one another. So that's what Jeremiah has done. And that's really what chapter 3 was about. So if you want to look at a little more closely, you can look at the notes for that. All of that to say that the structure of Lamentations even tells us that this is what's going on. That Lamentations and lamenting is meant to move us. And it's meant to move us together to God's presence. So it's not interesting. If you read the Psalms, we have a million Psalms. We have lots of Psalms, and many of them are by David. And a lot of them are lament psalms. In fact, 40% of the psalms are lament psalms. And in the lament, what you'll see is David laments toward God. But in most of the psalms, he invites the congregation of Israel with him. So most of the psalms, you will see that there are a combination of individual and communal lament, and they merge together. And that is what Lamentations does, is Jeremiah merges both the personal and the communal together, so that we go together to the throne of mercy and grace. So I kind of showed you, remember, we've talked about chiastic structure before. So each poem, we call chapters, but each poem goes toward. So Lamentations 1 says, to see brokenness. I see brokenness in the world. Lamentations 2, Jeremiah says, reminds me of my own brokenness, which is what should happen with us today. Lamentations 3 compels us then to join our brokenness with their brokenness. So that's the middle part. That's poem 3, that joining my brokenness with the world's brokenness. And then I have it kind of spaced out for you what he does in there. And then Lamentations 4, the poem there, in doing that, when I join my brokenness with another's brokenness, I make space for them to hear an assessment of their brokenness. So remember we said at the very beginning, I can't hear I'm wrong if I don't know I'm loved. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'm loved if someone doesn't join me in my brokenness, with their own brokenness. I don't know I'm loved when someone comes to me in their wholeness and says, oh, honey, I love you. It's almost as if you're saying, well, I know you're a mess. But look, if you just follow my example, you'll be okay, mm-hmm. right? Which is actually how we kind of do that a lot, right? We kind of do that in Christian circles. Like, oh, all you have to do, you know what? Just go to church, just read your Bible like I do, you know? Mm-hmm. Do Sabbath like I do, and you'll be good.
It's like the at least.
Yes, it's the at least, exactly. So it's that isn't what compels someone to hear like an assessment of what's really underneath it all. That doesn't compel that. That only says either, well, forget it, or, okay, I'm gonna try to do what you do. And it looks to you, somebody said, like a savior complex, right? It looks to you like I just need to do what they do. And it doesn't compel a movement toward God. It's still compelling a movement away from God, toward some kind of self-fixing. So that, what Jeremiah has done, what we're asked to do as we share our brokenness, actually makes space for someone to hear the assessment of what has caused that brokenness. And then from there, that makes then space for them to return to God's wholeness. Because God's the only one who has wholeness to give us where we actually are embraced. And I could go a lot more into all that structure thing, but structurally, that's what Lamentations is doing. The effects of Jeremiah's ministry, his willingness to show his brokenness. And, you know, when we look at 3 and it starts, I am the man who has seen and experienced affliction. I mean, I almost, and notice we didn't do our memory verse at all this time. I figured it was, there's just too much. And we probably all know that verse anyway. Actually, this is the verse I would choose. I am the man who has experienced affliction. Because I think that's where we need, that's why I wanted to really broaden that idea of, I am the man who is broken, and I want to come together so that we are both able to move toward the wholeness of God. And in order to do that, we do need to hear an assessment of where we're broken, of why we're broken, what's underneath it all. Today, in the United States, we think we're broken because, you know, our economy is whatever, or we don't have jobs, or we look at all this material, right? We look at, you know, we're broken this way. We're not where we were, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whatever people say. When God's saying, that's just a symptom, you need to look underneath. And I do think this is what, I actually do think, I think in the next couple of years, I think the church will have a lot of cleansing. And I think there's going to be more exposure to where the church is completely broken. So that we understand our brokenness is underneath it all is a disconnection with God's presence, with his order and his engagement without obstacle, without our supposedly good ideas. So what happens in Lamentations 4 is that Jeremiah actually assesses for them. So now Jeremiah has been with them. He's gone to the throne in his own brokenness, and he's invited them to come with them. Now he can say, so this is what I'm seeing. And he's actually in conversation with them. So this is what I'm seeing, Israel. And because they have suffered loss, and because someone has come with them in their loss, they have now the space to begin to see where the telos of their self-ordered lives are going to bring them. Remember, the telos is the end goal, is where it's going to end up. And Jeremiah gives them an honest assessment. He says, first of all, your experience of pain isn't the only thing. There's a bigger picture. So I want you to think about this. When a child is in a tantrum, you don't start talking to him right away, right? You don't say, hey, look, buddy, you know, if you would have done this, right? What's the first thing you do when a child's in a tantrum? How? How do you console them?
Hold them.
Yeah. It's exactly what you do, right? You go to him and you hold him. He is ranting, right? He is going all over the place and you hold him. And you hold him and you hold him. You're in with his brokenness there, right? You're not telling him, well, you did this wrong. I mean, that's just more fodder for tantrum. You hold them and you hold them until they've gotten to a place where that tantrum has subsided, right? So if you follow the structure of Lamentations, that's what's happened in 3. He's holding them right in the center in God's compassion. And now, all of you have done this, right? You've seen this happen. The child is the crying is done, the ranting is done, and they're, right? Right, that it's starting to, and now they can hear, right? They're going to hear some, it's like God taking Israel into the desert. I'm going to bring you here to a place where you can hear. And this is what Jeremiah has done with Israel. So here you are in a place you can hear your experience of pain. There's more out there. All you can see is your pain. But now that I've entered your pain with you, now you have space to breathe and be able to just begin to glimpse that there's more than just your pain here going on. We hate the pain. We hate the suffering of horrible things that happen. And we get so focused on that we forget that God is sovereign, which is my first reaction to everybody's reaction this morning was, oh my goodness, what's happened? God is in control. God is in control. God is sovereign and he is working good. That's the bigger picture that Jeremiah is going to give them. Look, your pain is not the whole world. That's not what's just the only thing that's happening. There's more going on that you don't see. And the reason you don't see it is because you're so focused on the loss of your own value system. What you have valued is what you are so upset about. I saw the kid in the toy store, right? He wants the toy, he wants the toy, he wants the toy, he wants the toy. And there goes the tantrum. And he's so focused on not getting the toy that he doesn't see that his mom has already put a whole bunch of other things in the cart for him. Right? Because he just wants this toy. That's the value he has. That's what Jeremiah is saying to Israel. Look, there's a whole other thing going on here. God has in the cart for you already a whole life. And all you can see is this. And that's why you can't see anything else, is because your value system is all about this. So Jeremiah says, so here's really what's going on at the end. And this is really tough stuff. In verse 1, he says that their value system is that wealth is going to bring them security. So that's what it means when it says, look at the gold, how dark it is. Where's chapter 4? Somebody read verse 1.
How dark the gold has become, how the pure gold has changed. The sacred stones are poured out at the corner of every street.
So he's saying to them, you have valued wealth as a means of security. Does that sound familiar? We have valued wealth as the means of security. We're so focused on that we're just devastated. Like, what will we do if we lose our wealth? But he also tells them, going on farther, in 17 and a couple other places, that they also value power as a means of security, which is why they've looked to the nations. Oh, there's nations that have all this power. We're going to look to them. In fact, the nation who had the biggest power at the time that this is happening is
Egypt.
It's Babylon.
Babylon.
It's Babylon.
Yeah, but they want to fly to Egypt.
Yeah, but they're looking to Babylon. They're looking like, look at how strong Babylon is. And they're looking to Egypt because Egypt was the power before Babylon. That was the biggest power. It's why they actually went down to Egypt in the first place. They're looking for power. That is what's going to give them security. And when they want power and security, it's not just in the political realm. In fact, more so for them, it's in the religious realm. They want their religious system to be the most powerful, to have, to really be able to bring power everywhere, which is exactly what we've done here, right? We've decided that Christianity has got to be the driving force rather than a servant priesthood. We want power, right? Which is exactly opposite of what Jesus did his whole life. He never vied for power. He did exactly the opposite. He eschewed power. He always went to the oppressed and served rather than. But Jeremiah is telling Israel, that's been your value system. You have valued wealth and power in order to be secure. And what has happened to that, what's the telos of that, what's the end result, is that human life itself has now become a commodity. In other words, they're now putting human life on the scale and to see how it weighs against wealth and power. They're saying, is this life valuable? Well, will it get us wealth? Will it get us power? And how much it can do that, that's how much that life is worth. So we see that in 2, that's what he's talking about in 2. The precious sons of Zion weighed against fine gold. So they're actually putting on the metaphorical scales, here's human life, here's gold. How does human life match up? So that's the telos of a value system that values wealth and power for security. They look at human life and they measure it against gold and they measure it against power. Do you think we do that? Mm-hmm. We do it all the time. It's why we have some of the laws we have. Think about some of the laws that we have that say that we have decided whether this life is valuable or not according to whether it helps us get wealth or it might prevent us from getting wealth. Can you think of anything that we've decided on? Abortion. It's exactly right. It's our right to choose, because some people just can't take care of them, and because we don't want the inconvenience, and we don't want to lose our power or our wealth. So what he's saying to Israel is, this is what you've done. Because you value wealth and power, you see everything in those terms. Everything is always, how much will it get us in wealth or power? Or how much will it take away in our wealth and power? And so we will evaluate everything on that. And not just material things, but we will value human life on that aspect. And you'll see that in 3, it says that they have become cruel. Cruel like ostriches. From what I understand about ostriches, they're a pretty mean animal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they understand, that's true. But mostly they run after and like bite all the time, right? Somebody read verse 10.
The hands of compassionate women boiled their own children. Oh, I hate this one. They became food for them because of the destruction of the daughter of my people.
Yeah. So what he's saying is, feeding themselves has replaced compassion. Cruelty has replaced love. Feeding themselves has replaced compassion. So that, do you see where those scales, Jeremiah is trying to say, you've constructed a scale where you're going to put everything on that scale and it's going to weigh against your wealth and your power. And you're even putting your own babies on that scale to say, well, wait, if I don't eat, I'm not going to be able to get any power. I'm not going to be able to do these things. So that the baby's just taking food away from me. He's not giving anything to me. That's what's happening. And I think it's really a strong place there that he says, compassionate women. Women who said they were compassionate. Remember, Israel is supposed to be the priests who are compassionate, who show God's mercy toward people. These people who say we're compassionate are using this system that weighs people against their own desires to eat.
Would you say that's true? It might ruffle some feathers, but birth control is the same thing. I mean, we're controlling.
Yeah. So all the way, and that's what Jeremiah's doing. He's getting all the way down to the nitty-gritty where we are, which I think that's where we are in the church. We're getting down to, look, we've got to look how much we have rationalized our control as if it's a good thing. And God says, your control is never a good thing. Mm-hmm. Only my control, only my ordering. The end result of any human system, of any human ordering, is always going to be that human life is relegated to valueless. That will be the end result. Have we not seen that? In this last year, I don't care what side you heard, both sides are toward that place of, we're going to make sure that our life is protected. I mean, that's the clamoring for rights all the time, right? It's always that. So when I was in high school, so I remember this so well, like 1972, I remember sitting, so I went to a Christian high school, and I remember a chapel speaker, and I remember the chapel speaker said, so remember, this is before abortion laws. I remember the chapel speaker saying, if we as the church allow our country to say that we can forego a baby's life, we will also do it on the other end of the spectrum. Yeah. And the spectrums will be coming in. And he said, if we allow this, we will also allow the killing of our older people. Yeah. We will allow killing of our sick people. And he said that. And so I'm 14, and I'm thinking, no, that could never happen. Mm-hmm. And here I sit, and I think, whew, it just gets closer and closer and closer. Because we believe that what will keep us secure is wealth and power. And we believe it in the church as much as we believe it in the society. But they're able to hear. Chapter 4 is pretty amazing, because not only is Jeremiah able to say that, look, this is your value system, this is the end result, it changes in 17 to now it's Israel speaking. And Israel says, yep, our eyes have failed. Not only has Israel moved out of the ranting to being able to breathe in a little bit better rhythm, but now they're able to verbalize a confirmation that Jeremiah is right. They finally, it's like I'm over giving a tantrum about what's going on and saying, you're right, our eyes have failed. Remember the whole thing about a priest's eyes are always at the center. And they're saying, our eyes have failed. We've taken our eyes off the center of order. We've taken our eyes off of God being the center of order. And we've looked around, says in 17, the end of 17, we've looked toward the nations. We've wanted what they have, independent control. That's what we've wanted. That's what we've valued. And that's what they took. Israel hears the assessment of their value system and says, you're right, Jeremiah, that is what we've done. We have taken our eyes off of God's order, and we've looked toward the nations, and it has brought us to our end. So it's interesting that because of Jeremiah's compassionate witness, they're able to come and hear now an assessment and say, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what we've been doing. That's exactly what has happened here. And they go even farther. So not only do they agree with Jeremiah, but they actually say, and Jeremiah's brought them to the place of, this is where the bottom line is. And they say, yeah, and you know what we've really lost? In 20. Somebody read 20.
The breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, was captured in their pits, of whom we have said, under his shadow, we shall live among the nations.
Okay. Does it remind you of anything that we've already looked at?
Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis. Right. They know that they have lost their special identity as priests. Right? This is Genesis 2. This is, and remember, Anytime scripture does this, where it uses words that, like, oh, I've heard that somewhere before, it means for you to understand the whole story. So it wants you to go back to Genesis 2 and say, oh, this is where Adam is given the priesthood, and which Israel was given the priesthood again through Abraham. So it's saying, yeah, we understand that the loss here is the loss of our identity as priests, that we've lost our belonging in God's Sabbath place, and we've lost our purpose. The breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed. Whenever you see that, you can always think about priests. And it's captured in their pits. So their pits is the nation's pits, the pits of self-centered order. And in the end of it, the telos then of self-ordering, all of this comes about from them deciding to define good for themselves, to define what life is, to self-order. They wanted to live like and with the nations. And now Israel, through the process of lament with Jeremiah, they're able to come to the same conclusion and actually be able to make it flower to say, this is what we've really lost. So the point of lament is to come to the point where you come with others and together you come to understand our loss isn't the loss of our health or our wealth or our well-being. The loss is the loss of our identity. The loss is the loss of connection with God and others. That's our loss. That's where lament should move us if we're actually priests together in lament. And so he wants them to understand that there is a purpose in their suffering. He wants them to understand that it wasn't for naught that God brought about the suffering. He needs to expose to them the telos of a self-ordered world. He needs for them, we need to see that when we order our own lives, the whole world is affected, and the telos is always going to be death. It's always going to be chaos, more and more chaos for all of us. They saw that their own disorder brought about disorder within the community, within the family and the community and society. That's what we should be seeing as well. And that's what God wants to expose. And this is why I think today is such a great day. I think it's the beginning of God exposing the church, the church's disorder, of us pretending that we can get what we want and be okay and just keep going and not see that what we're losing is connection with God. We might have gained our so-called rights and we've lost connection with the world and with God himself. So, number one purpose of suffering is to expose the telos of disorder, where it's going to lead. And number two, it's to defend us against disconnection. God says over and over again, he said in Lamentations, I am going to defend your cause. I am your lawyer here, and I'm going to defend you against disorder. And I'm going to fight for you, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that you are not connected to disorder. I want to disconnect you from that. And sometimes that disconnection, if you had cancer in your body, would you say to the surgeon, don't cut me. I don't want that cut out. Just let it be there and I'll manage it. Or would you say, take it out now. Like now, I don't care what you have to do. When I was in labor with Christian and he was too big and I was in distress, and I remember being in so much pain and knowing there was nothing that was going to keep this kid alive or me alive except to have him cut out. I remember, 31 years ago, I remember going, do it now! Now! I just wanted them to just get me in there and cut me open now to save our lives, right? And yeah, there was a lot of healing that took place after that, a lot. And it was not fun. But it saved our lives to be able to be cut open. That's exactly what God does with our suffering, is I want you to get to the point where you understand that cutting suffering is necessary to pull you away from your own order. And then Jeremiah tells them in 11 and in 22 that their suffering is now coming to an end. that God's wrath is finite. Something we don't understand. We often talk about God's love and God's wrath being different sides of the same coin. I want to temper that a little in saying God's wrath is an aspect of his love. It's not his character. It's an aspect of his love. Love is his character, and wrath is an aspect of love, just like any parent's love, right? You see your kid running into the street, and you scream at him. And in fact, if the screaming doesn't help, what do? You yank him, right? And you don't care if you're going to bruise him. You don't care if you hurt his arm. You are going to yank him out of there. That wrath is your love, right? That's an aspect of your love, that you will do whatever it takes to get him out of there. But that wrath is a momentary thing. And it says it all over Scripture, God's wrath is momentary, but his compassion lasts forever. That's his character. His character is feeling with you. His character is doing everything it takes to make you connected to life. And he says at the end, 20 and 22, Jeremiah, so it goes back to Jeremiah speaking at the end of 4:22. And Jeremiah says, so yes, your enemies are going to go, huh, see, you're broken and God's judging you. And Jeremiah says, don't worry, Jerusalem. Don't worry, Israel. God will judge all value systems. He will expose all of them. Don't worry about it. God's in control. He's not going to allow that to happen because he doesn't want anybody to be connected to disorder. He doesn't want anyone's value system to disrupt pericritic life and keep us addicted to our own rule. So he will expose it. And here, unspoken is, but it will be in his timing and the way he wants it. And all of that goes back to, if we're in disorder, God deals with us and we go, okay, God, you're right. It's your order. And then we say, but what about them? And God says, in my timing. If we go, well, wait, you're going right back to your order again, right? It's right back to, no, I want them to feel exactly how I feel now. God says, your waiting in my order is part of the submission to my order, that my order is good. We don't know the whole aspect, the whole picture. We can't see it all, but God can. So that's what he tells them in 4. So we have in 4, Jeremiah having brought compassionate lament with Israel, bringing them to a place where they can hear an assessment, and not only hear the assessment, but actually confirm it and say, yep, Jeremiah, you're right. And we understand that our real loss is our loss of connection with God, our loss of identity, our loss of being able to, in fact, that I think there, oh, is in 5 that we'll see. They really understand what has happened with their loss. So when we get into 5, so remember that Lamentations is written in an acrostic, right? So we have Lamentations 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They all have 22 verses except for 3. It has 66. Each verse is begins with the alphabet, with Aleph, Bet, Gimel. We have that all the way through. We have that in 1. We have that in 2. We have that in 3, but 3 verses instead of 2 verses each. We have that in 4. In 5, interesting enough, we still have the 22 verses, but no longer the acrostic structure anymore. We actually lose that pattern, so that although there are 22 verses, so it's still in God's boundaries, now there's no beginning with Aleph, Bet, Gimel. Now it's whatever. There's no specific letter that they start with. They could start with any letter. Which number 1 says they've come to that place where the tantrum kid, now he's not even going, now he's actually breathing. There's actually a rhythm. So what we have here is no longer does he need to spew out from A to Z, and that's the whole point of A to Z, spew out everything that you're feeling. Spew it out, spew it out, spew it out. And then in 4, I'll spew out all the assessment from A to Z. Here's the assessment. Yep, that's our assessment. In 5, we lose that. There's no need anymore to go from A to Z. What has changed, though, is a rhythm. Now, this you actually will be able to see in English. so that there has been no poetic rhythm in 1 through 4. It's just been an acrostic. We've gone this, and we've done this, and we've done this, and we've done this, and there's this intensity. And in 5, we actually now have a poetic rhythm. And what we have, it's called synonymous parallelism. And what that means is the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse say the same things in different ways. So synonymous, same thing, right? Parallelism, they're parallel. So 5:1. Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our reproach. Same thing, right? It says the same thing. Every single verse is the same thing. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers. Our houses to aliens. Do you see that? No. What's happening now is a rhythm. And the rhythm is a rhythm of conversation. So now Israel is at that point of the tantrum's done, the breathing has gotten back, and now Israel is actually able to speak with God in an actual dialogue. There's a dialogue here, and the rhythm is supposed to show you that, that there's actually a rhythm of natural breathing and able to speak in a way that isn't focused on pain, but is focused on engagement. So that Jeremiah has been able to move them from lament to hearing to now engagement with God, to being in God's presence and being able to talk with God rather than at God. So all up until this time, if they've mentioned God at all, it's been an at, right? It's like, it's just slamming God with all of their woes, which is good. Lament is meant to do that, but it's actually meant to move toward a place where you're actually engaging with God so that there's this. So that's, do you see the rhythm? Am I losing anyone there? Okay. So that's structurally how lament helps us. So if we were reading this in Hebrew, it would be really, really obvious to us. So we've been reading an acrostic all the time. We've read, you know, verse 1a, verse 2b, verse 3c. We've read that, and all of a sudden 5 is like no ABC, but all of a sudden we can hear, it's almost like music has started, like there's this rhythm, and it's a beautiful rhythm, and it's a breathing type of a rhythm. So we see that Jeremiah has been able to move them now to engagement with God. He's brought them to the throne with him. He's modeled his own ability to do that in 3, and now they're able to do that as well. And the interesting thing, this is something I think we need to understand. When we are in lament with someone, we are to model for them going to God with it, being able to engage with God with it, with them with us. But it's us engaging so that when they take up that movement and they come and engage, it's their voice engaging. It's not us speaking for them. So that there is actually a place where we back off. We don't go away, but we back off. We become those cloud of witnesses. That standing there with them, but we allow them a voice. I think, and I always forget his name, Ra. How do you say it?
Soon-Chan Ra
writes a lot about this in his Prophetic Lamentations book. About how we think as the church we need to go, we think going with someone means to speak for them. Like we're gonna go into the inner city and we're gonna talk for these people and get them, like we're trying to use our power, right, to get them. He says, no, be with them, go with them to the throne, and then let them speak. And that's what Jeremiah is doing here. So in 5, it's all Israel speaking. And Israel is able to now speak, now that Jeremiah has gone with them, modeled it for them in their presence. He hasn't kept it to himself. And now they're able to do it in community. And I hope you recognize that in the whole of Lamentations, none of this is a private lamentation. None of this is lamenting in private. It's all in the community. You'll see that in the Psalms as well. Individual praise and lament should always end up in community. It should always go to there. That's part of the movement. So in 15 through 18, we have Israel having a new vulnerability now. they're able to share with God. They're talking with him, and they've learned from Jeremiah that they can actually be vulnerable. So they say that they have lost joy and are in mourning. The actual word joy, what does it say? I didn't write the verse down. What is it? Oh, 15. The joy of our hearts has ceased. The word ceased is Sabbath, which I think is really interesting. The joy, our joy is in Sabbath, and that's not where we are. That's where joy is, in Sabbath. We're not there. We know that. And this is a great vulnerability, because I think sometimes we want to bring people out of lament, and we want to force them. We want to say, just be happy, right? And that, isn't that a big famous song?
Don't worry, be happy.
That's kind of what we want to do, right? Instead of wait and allow them to say, I don't have joy right now. And they're able to say that. They know they're no longer at home. They're not in that Sabbath space of where God is ordering. They know that. They also say in 16 that they've lost the glory. What does it say? 16, the crown has fallen from our head. Obviously, the crown of being a royal priest. They know that they've lost it. And they say, why? Because we have sinned. The word sin is that chata again, that forfeit, because we forfeited it. Not because you've taken it away, because we've given it away. We have decided that what the nations had was more important, and we've given it away. We forfeited the glory that you gave us. And in 17, we don't have what it takes to keep living with purpose. I love, this is an interesting verse. Because of this, our heart is faint. You know what the word faint means there? This is so interesting. The word faint there is actually means menstruous. It means we're losing. Where are you in the place when you are menstruating?
Miserable.
Yeah, but physiologically?
Tired.
You're losing your life.
You're losing blood. Yeah. Actually,
you are not able to reproduce. You're not able to bear fruit. My heart, our heart is not able to produce fruit. Our, who we are is not able to be fulfilled in our purpose, right? Isn't that what priests were to do? To bring more and more image bearers into priesthood? And they are admitting, we've not done that. We're not able to do that because we aren't in Sabbath, because we aren't in the place of God ordering. I actually think that's a really great picture. Like, we are unable to do that. And the funny thing is, you know, all of you came up with this, ooh, that's not, oh, we don't like that time, all that time. Yeah, that Israel, that's how Israel feels. And it's interesting that they would use that word, because that was a time of uncleanness, right? That's what they're saying. We're unclean, and we are unable to produce fruit. We're unable to bear and be fruitful for you. And then in 18, Mount Zion is desolate. We don't have any place to meet you even. We know what we've lost here. So they have come, and interesting enough, they've come on their own. Jeremiah brought them to this place, but now they're able to say, we've really lost it. We have given up, we've forfeited our priesthood and our purpose, our identity and our purpose, and we cannot do anything about it. We can't get it back. We've tried to fix it. Remember, Lamentations is all about correcting that paradigm that we can fix on our own. And now in 19, they recognize the only place of order, the only place of getting life, is God being the center of order. The word rule there, he says, you, O Lord, they say, you, O Lord, rule forever. Rule means to sit. And we know what that means, right? Where God is at home, ordering and engaging without obstacle. They are absolutely affirming the Sabbath rhythm of Genesis 1 here. They recognize that's the only place of life, And then in two, so we have to understand how Hebrew language would have worked. When they say, why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? It's a rhetorical. It's like, you haven't forgotten us. We know it, right? You haven't abandoned us. We know it, right? Because that's what they just learned. He hasn't abandoned us in all of that. And they're seeking for him. Answer us, right? Right? We know this, right? Because you haven't forsaken us. So it's the seeking of God. And when you look at what's happening with Israel here, what they do, if you go back and look at what Jeremiah has done, it's exactly a reflection of what Jeremiah has done in 3. So he recognizes God as the center of order. He seeks God and then waits for God. And this is the big thing. Most people who read Lamentations really hate how it ends. Because what do we want all the time? We want a happy ending, right? We want an actual, okay, we've done this, now we should get this. What do we really want? We want a transaction, right? We want, well, okay, I've lamented it, I've done all this, so here's the answer. But the problem is, when I say I'm just going to submit to God's order, then it's God's timing, right? Which means waiting is actually part of submitting to God's order being the only way of life. So in 21, they say, restore us to you. Right there, they admit, we can't do it. You need to restore us. You need to get us back to you. And this is the first time. So if you've noticed, I hope you've noticed, rest and restore has been in every chapter. But in every chapter up till now, it's been, we've tried to restore ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we've tried to restore ourselves to our own wealth, to our power, to where we were. Finally, Israel gets to the point, God, restore us, what? To you. That's where we need to be restored. We don't need our material stuff restored. We don't need our power restored. We need to be restored to you. We need relationship restored. This is the biggest confession that Israel makes. Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. It's the only way of restoration is to you. And then renew our days as of old. So the renew is to repair us to the days as of old. What days of old are they talking about? Yeah. Yeah. So at the very beginning, it says, the very beginning. Restore us to the very beginning where we are enjoined to come into Sabbath space. So repair our days back to the order that you set out. And in fact, whenever the Jews talk about our days, remember all the days they have? All of the days were meant to celebrate again Sabbath space, the place where they get to come into the presence of God. So it always goes back to, that's where we want. We want you to repair it. We can't. We can't do this. And the fact, and what has happened is, with Jeremiah sharing his brokenness and then going to the throne, what he has said is, going to the throne, going to the presence, going into Sabbath is a gift. It's not because I did what I needed to do to get there. It's a gift that I was able to go. If Jeremiah had gone in fullness and wholeness, like, I haven't done anything wrong, Israel, but I'm going to show you how to get there, then he would have said, Sabbath is an obligation, is something you do to get into there. But he did that with his brokenness, and in showing his brokenness and going into the throne, he shows it's a gift always. Sabbath is a gift. The ability to enter into God's presence, into the place where God orders, without obstacle, that's a gift to be able to do that. And I say that as a warning, as we've studied Sabbath, that we need to be careful not to make, and we so easily do this, right? We need to be careful not to make Sabbath, and all we've learned about Sabbath, a place where we have to do things to get there. It's a gift. So knowing what Sabbath is allows us to see that we get that we have permission to go there. I think it's C.S. Lewis that wrote something about our lives are we live by permission, not by right. And we live in Sabbath by permission, by gift, not by right, and not by activity. And so we have then no final resolution here. We want the quick answers. We want to really, when we want a quick answer, what we're really saying is, I just want to get back to the place where it was comfortable. What did Israel say in the wilderness? Just bring us back to Egypt. We had food there. And that's kind of what we, right? We want to get back there. When we finally get to the point where we say, however long, whatever it takes, I'll wait to see what you have for us, God. That's when we know we have lamented and moved into that place. What it emphasizes that, and the reason that God doesn't right here say, okay, now I'm going to bring you back and we're going to build the temple and everything's going to be great. He wants to emphasize that the material wealth and the power is only a means to help their priesthood. It's not the end. So he doesn't restore that to them. He wants to restore their relationship. Therefore, Lamentations doesn't have a nice, neat little bow on the end of it. He wants to restore them in relationship. That's where he's been going. The wealth and the power, if he restores that at all, is supposed to be a tool to be priests, to be inviting into perichoretic life. What happens, though, to them? This is happening as they... So remember, Lamentations is written to the people who've been left in Jerusalem. Most of Israel has been exiled to Babylon. And they're lamenting. Like, these are the poorest of the poor that have stayed there. Jeremiah has stayed there. And they're lamenting. And they're not seeing, like, well, when are you going to bring them back? Well, God eventually does bring them back, right? So we studied Haggai. We saw in Ezra and Nehemiah, we saw that God brings them back. And he does restore the temple. But do you remember what Haggai says about the temple? What kind of a temple are they able to rebuild? Anybody remember? Is it a nice one? Is it a big one? Is it like Solomon's temple?
That's not the glory.
No, in fact, yeah, they mourn. They say, this is not like what we had. Mm-hmm. And Haggai says, nope, that's coming. Because what he has done in Lamentations is he says, wait, I will bring my glory. I want you to begin to engage with me in relationship rather than in just activity. I want you to engage me in relationship. And I want you to engage with me long enough in relationship so that when I restore the temple to its fullest glory, that temple is actually going to engage with you in conversation.
Is that what he did with Job? He had to wait.
Yes, that, yeah, there's a lot more going on in Job than that, though.
Right. But he had to wait to be restored.
Right, and waiting to be restored is always a means for us to begin a rhythm of engagement, of relationship, so that when God restores, he says, the glorious temple, that temple will actually be in engagement with you. What do you think he's talking about there?
Jesus.
Yeah. Because Jesus says he's the temple, right? Mm-hmm. And he's actually engaging with them. So he's setting up Israel to see a new kind of a temple with glorious engagement with them. And then, beyond that, because he's always moving us, beyond an engagement with them, an engagement within them, when we become the temple. So all of this is connected. You can't just take Lamentations and just study Lamentations. You have to understand that it's still a movement, right? It's a movement toward where God is bringing them so that he's preparing them to begin to accept a temple that will engage with them. So that when Jesus says, I am the temple, there are lots of Jews who would have gone, wow, is it possible? That this is what God has been preparing us for. And there's lots and lots and lots of things as you begin to study more and more the Old Testament and their history, you begin to see how God prepares them for that eventual incarnation of the temple in Christ, and then eventually in us.
Jill, yeah. Isn't that the resolution of Lamentations, is that God will keep his covenant and yes. he will restore.
Yes, exactly.
And we were going through Jeremiah, like, still at the end, but I will restore the fortune
of the temples. Yep.
So I thought, like, that was resolution for me.
Yes, yes. And that, and it's not the resolution though that we want all the time, right? We want a, like a full, like,
clean.
Yeah, right, happily ever after. Like, okay, it's clean, it's done, and kind of, you know, let's get back to life again. He's destroying the lives that we build so that we can have this restoration of living in Sabbath, right? Mm-hmm. Sabbath is meant to be all the time, mm-hmm. and he's restoring us to that. So that as he lives in us, Sabbath can be all the time, but it's a process. It's never. We tend to look at life in events, right? We actually that's kind of how. And I actually thought about doing this exercise of, all right, I want you just to describe your entire life in 10 events. And I actually think that we could actually do that, because we're very event oriented people. We tend to actually look at Christ's life in one event, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why we've gotten messed up a little bit. Because we go, it's really two events. It's the death and the resurrection. Right. But then we miss the whole way that God has recapitulated everything in Christ's life. So that it begins with the conception all the way to him living within us. It's a process. It's not an event. When we pare things down to event, we make these nice little neat packages. So, to speak to your answer, yes, the promise of restoration means it's happening now, right? We talked about this 2 years ago. Everything's restoration, right? No matter what's happening in your life, it's why I still have my little pig there. And every once in a while, I look at that and say, this too is restoration. This hard thing in my life, this is restoration. That's the hope that they have here. So when the Jew reads Lamentation, they actually don't see that this is a hard ending. It's like hope. Like, oh no, he is restoring. And the suffering I go through is part of that restoration process. And he's doing for me what needs to be done. So yes, good answer. And for us, as we sit, we don't like the ending of, so the very ending, verse 22, unless you've utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us, that again is the way a Jew would talk. It's kind of like, it's kind of sarcastic. So it's not a question there, it's not a doubt there, it's actually a, we know that's not true. I wish I could put a little Jewish accent and say it the way that they would probably say it. It's rhetorical. It's a reminder that that's not God's character. They've learned that through there. And it is when they return from exile. So after Lamentations, after they've understand the suffering and the good of it, that the people do become a people that are much more focused on God's word and conversation with him than they have in the past. So until this time, they're described as idolatrous, but not afterwards. And what has happened is when they went off into Babylon, remember, they've lost the temple, they've lost the sacrifice. So now they have to figure out, how do we engage with God? And this is when most of the Torah is written down in Babylon. And now the Torah, the scriptures, become their place of engagement with God. And so now it's words and words together. And they bring that back, and there is a renewed people of Israel. Now, of course, they're still completely disordered, but we do see this shift after Lamentations, and Israel comes back. So here's my question. We have 15 minutes left. I can either go through really quickly the example of Jeremiah, or we can talk about what we've seen in Lamentations, your questions, maybe your observations, and or how Sabbath has kind of worked into Lamentations. So what's your choice?
I'd like to kind of do the rest of the story as Lamentations, put it, which is not the end of the story.
You mean you want to hear what Jeremiah's example?
Right.
How about anybody else? Anybody else have a thought?
I don't know what I want.
You don't know what you want?
Yes, oh. Yes.
We want
everything.
Both,
yeah,
I know.
We want everything.
Yeah. We want it all.
What do you want to do, Joe?
What?
What do you want to do?
Honestly, my throat is very sore right now. I'd like to hear a few minutes from you of any kind of either questions or observations that are roiling around your head. And then I'll just do a real quick move through Jeremiah's example.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
Way back when you asked, what do you do when a child throws a tantrum?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, console him.
Mm-hmm.
No, I send him to his room until he settles down. And then when you're ready and you've thought about this, mm-hmm. then you come back. Or we could go to them after they've settled down and mm-hmm. talk to them about that. So the different...
Yeah, let's think about that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Does a child have the ability to be able to think through everything?
No. Mm-hmm. Not,
it depends
not at all.
On their age.
That's right.
A younger child, no. But an older
it does.
Teen, maybe a
but what you've just done when you've sent them away from you.
Isolation. Separated.
You separated, right?
Well, if you just let them lay there and kick and scream, and you just.
God lets me lay there and kick and scream.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Pardon me?
I said, God lets me do that.
Yep.
That's right.
He does. But he does gather us up, right?
Right.
It is the call of a priest to gather stuff. And I,
but
so.
Not during the kicking and screaming necessarily.
Sometimes you do.
Yeah, I actually think you do. And here's, I was much more a parent like that. I was much more, you go off, separate from mm-hmm. everybody else. Mm-hmm. I would do it differently now.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But I think when I look at the big picture as a priest, and someone is really hurting so much that they have no idea how to deal with it, so they kick and scream.
Mm-hmm.
I think the worst thing I can do for them
mm-hmm.
is to
that's
walk away.
That's right.
To
that's
make
right.
them alone. I think that's
the
worst thing.
Their pain has to be in isolation.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I know I'm guilty of it.
Yeah. Every one of us is guilty of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're really,
mm-hmm.
we have fear of that,
mm-hmm.
right? We have fear of dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things that, thinking about being a priest and doing that is, we're not coming to them with answers.
Mm, I was going to say.
Which I think is what we always want, right?
Right.
We think when someone's in pain, we need to come with them with answers. Mm-mm. In truth, when you're in pain, do you want answers?
No.
You absolutely don't. In fact, it infuriates me when someone comes to me with an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I say sometimes, I don't want an answer from you.
Mm-hmm.
I just want you to be here with
that's
me.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right.
That's what we're called to as priests. Priests don't have the answers. Priests are supposed to be with in perichoretic union. I mean, if we say, hey, the best thing for you to do is to be in perichoretic union, and we say it from on top of the pit,
yeah.
I mean, what are we saying? It's like saying, I'm going to teach you how to drive. Now I'm going to write all the instructions down, you get in the car and do it.
Well, teach you how to swim.
Yeah. But it's the being with that actually allows the calming down, and what it also allows is them not trying to make a transaction with God. Because that's the only thing we know how to do on our own. But together, we can come and be broken. And I do think that's a necessary thing. So give me an example. So outside of a child having a tantrum, somebody that you know is hurting, painful, whether they've sinned, somebody else has sinned against them, whatever it is, whatever kind of disorder, something is horrible happening. Think about what that looks like, and what you really do physically and eating.
I actually, it's a story that then I was able to apply to my life. It was a story about a couple that had retired, and they opened up an orphanage for troubled kids. And
the orphanage would grow, and they would have get these kids coming in, and lots of transformation, and there was this one kid that they could not get through to, and he was very difficult. And one day, the gentleman who was in charge of the orphanage was going to cut the boy's hair, and when the boy came down, and when I say boy, he was a teenager, he was older, he came down and he had Vaseline all in his hair, and the man had the scissors and the boy was sitting down and he said, God, what do I do? And God said, love him. Mm-hmm. And he put the scissors down and he walked in front of the boy and picked him up and he held him. And the boy broke because the boy was like, everybody says they're going to love me. You know, where's the point that you're going to stop loving me too? And that story, obviously, has really affected me.
Right.
And I was married to an addict, and I have three sons, and my middle one's an addict. Mm-hmm. And he was addicted to Xanax, and he was a mess. Mm-hmm. And in the lowest part, he was very unlovable. And he was doing all sorts of things that just made him unlovable and looked terrible, greasy, gross, blah, blah, blah. And I remember we were standing on the landing of my house, and he just came to me, just so unlovable. And I thought about that, and I grabbed him and I held him, and he just broke. And you know what? He doesn't do Xanax anymore. We got issues. I always say he's the one who keeps me humble. But, you know, it goes against what we want to do. Guess what we want to do. And that man, you know, to do what he did was
remarkable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very remarkable.
Those kind of stories are exactly what Jeremiah did. It's exactly what he did. And I think it's what we do. So one of the exercises I originally wanted to have you do is I wanted you to draw a wedding table, and I wanted you to put 10 seats around it. And then I wanted you to fill those seats, and I was going to give you a list of people I wanted you to fill them with. People like an addict, someone who's been in prison, someone who has an abortion, someone who, I actually had Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on there. I had all of these people, and I wanted you to decide who you were going to put in there and name them with a name. And then I wanted you... Because I think sometimes we get overwhelmed, like, how do I do this? How do I possibly break with everybody? I mean, there's just so many people in the world that are broken. Mm-hmm. When you sit around a wedding table with 10 people, who are the people that you talk to?
The two, right?
So after you had done this exercise, I wanted you to look at those two next to you, whoever they were, and you name them. And then I wanted you to ask God to bring those two people into your life. Mm-hmm. Just two. Broken people. But not so that you could give them charity. Mm-hmm. But so that you could share your brokenness. And that in your brokenness, you guys could go together. I think sometimes we get overwhelmed because we think the social issues are so big. Mm-hmm. And we don't. And unless it's personal, we don't know how to enter that, right? But I think that we have a chance to be invited into those places, personal. I will tell you that before both of my kids lived in Syria, it would never have occurred to me to ever be connected with a Middle Easterner, Muslim, Christian, whatever. But when my kids start having friends that are all of those, all of a sudden it becomes very personal to me. And everything that, for me, that happens in Syria is very personal because I know people there. Because I know their names and I know their families. I know their faces. It becomes very personal. But you actually have to take a risk, right, to be willing. I actually think God has put 10 people in on your table. And I actually think there's two people on either of your sides that are in serious brokenness. And I think you're actually a neighbor to other people, and you're in serious brokenness. And I think that sharing, is available to us. But I also think it means we stop isolating ourselves. One of the best places to isolate ourselves is to live in the suburbs. Hate to say that, and I don't want to live in the city. I have no desire. But it is a place where we isolate ourselves most. Mm-hmm. It's really what Ross says in his book. He's very much, like, he hates the suburbs in that it's a way to isolate ourselves, mm-hmm. right, from people. Mm-hmm. But here's the truth. You have people in your neighborhood who are broken, too.
Oh, yeah, it's very broken. Mm-hmm.
It's very broken. Mm-hmm. Probably more so, but we just have a lot of polish. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of wax that we can put on. Anyway, those are just suggestions that you pray about. I think the worst thing we could do is walk away from Lamentations and go, oh yeah, we need to lament with people. And then literally never seek out mm-hmm. places to lament with.
We have to fight. I think I'm learning. We have to fight for it.
We do have to fight for it.
Like, we have to fight for those places and spaces that we will lament yes. with people and mm-hmm. allow God to put us in those places.
Yep.
Where, like, we actually have to fight more, I think, for it than we realize.
Yes, I think you're
right. I think we can find ourselves.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about, a couple years ago, I started praying that I would see, and I just, and my thought is everybody in my life is broken. Like, I see it everywhere I go. Uh-huh. And but it's not because they've changed. It's because my eyes have changed.
Right.
And, you know, I work with junior high girls. And sure. a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about bullying. And the table that I was with was talking about two girls that were really bullying them on the bus. And they were sitting behind me at another table. And I'm like, how do I handle that we have the bullies here? And I'm talking to these girls. And for a weird scenario, someone pulled me out of the room and I came back and that was a table I went to. And I looked at these girls who I knew a little bit about their background and thought, what do I say? Mm-hmm. So I said, so have you ever bullied anybody? No. Do you think you've ever done something that you thought was really funny and hurt other people? And they're like, oh yeah. And so me and the other high school leader told stories that we had done in junior high that I am not proud of. But as soon as we said that, they completely opened up. And now one of the girls who's really... she just has a horrible life. And she will not leave my side. Mm-hmm. And all I keep saying to the high school girls is, all we have to do is love them. Mm-hmm. But I think we see it. I think we're around it all the time, and we just blinders on because it hurts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it hurts. Mm-hmm. It hurts.
Thank you.
There's so much more that I would love to explore with us. I think I just would like to go to prayer. Are there a couple people? I would like to have at least two other people praying. I'll start. Would there be other two people that would pray for us that we would be priests of lament with others? Can I ask two others?
Can I add one thing before we
yes.
I understand what you're saying about the suburbs and being in the suburbs, but I think we need to be aware that and I know it from a kid perspective, from our demographics of our schools, the amount of students on free and reduced
yeah.
lunch
yeah.
just
yeah.
at this school right here has like over doubled in the last few years.
Really?
The amount of kids that are homeless that go to school in Naperville has increased
yeah.
as well. And homeless doesn't mean that they're living in a box, but it means they're going from house
right.
to house mm-hmm. with friends.
Mm-hmm.
Or so I think that, you know, as we think that we're isolated, we just need to open our eyes a little
mm-hmm.
bit more to the changing demographics of our community, because
mm-hmm.
it's right
that's
here.
That's a good word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a really good word.
So, you're right, we're still isolated. It's
yeah.
not like being, you know, in an urban environment, or like where we're going, you know, like we're dealing with people who are incarcerated, who are working, like, you know, at the,
right.
I mean, it is different,
right?
But it's here.
But
it's here,
yeah.
here. It's
yeah.
here
yeah.
bigger than it's ever been.
So. That's good to know. That's good to know.
One thing I just wanted to say, something I appreciated so much that you said was, you know, while we're in there lamenting, being with that person who's in the pit, it's still also maintaining that example of how we are looking to God, and instead of trying to fix them,
yep.
but still maintaining that example, and you know, my daughter having gone through some real brokenness and having literally strangers coming alongside of her doing exactly that this last week on the phone with her, it's the first time I started hearing her talking that same way with her life that she's been showing that example of. And she literally sighed and said, "Mom, I feel like I'm becoming whole."
Mm-hmm. That's big.
Mm-hmm.
That's really big.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can say it enough. We are broken, and mm-hmm. we don't have answers to give people. We have our lives to give to one another. I hope that you don't forget these broken lives that you've left on my table here. I'm going to pray, and if somebody wants to join in, that would be wonderful. Father, we sometimes just come before you without any words.
Mm-hmm.
Our heart breaks for all of us. Our heart breaks for those that we have ignored and for the pain that we have tried to shove under the couch. And our heart breaks for our own pain and our own brokenness that we have tried to polish up. We are so grateful that you broke yourself for us and that you have asked us to remember it, to reenact our own brokenness, that we might share our brokenness with others, and that in that brokenness, we say, come on, the only place I know to go is the one who has the words for eternal life. Father, I thank you that you remain steadfast in your compassion. And I pray that we would live in that compassion, that we might have compassion to give, that you would bring us to the places of exposing our disorder and the places that we're going toward death, and that we might desire life, that you would give each of us someone to come alongside of us, that we might come alongside of others, that we would have the courage and take the risk and fight for being in those places where we can engage with the broken, and that we would not think we're coming in to rescue, but that we would realize we belong at that table of brokenness.
Remember to look and to see who we are. That we are priests.
Mm-hmm.
Help us bring forward our hesitation, our fear, and worry. To ask that it's through suffering and it's through cutting us open, Lord, that we grow. Oh, Lord, we do not want to ask for that. But we know. We trust. We trust you, Lord. Spirit, move us. Move us forward. Help us lift our hands to share with those around us, Lord, those that are at our table and that are right next to us.
Mm-hmm.
You've placed them right next to us, Lord. We need your strength to lift our hands to share our broken lives.
Yes.
Our broken lives. Continue to reveal that to us. What does that look like? What are the words? Where do we walk? What do we say?
Mm-hmm.
And I just hear you saying, love them.
Mm-hmm.
Love them. As I have loved you.
Lord, help us not to get so caught up in our own busyness that we are neglectful of others who need us to come alongside them and share whatever it is that we can give them, give to them, maybe nothing but ourselves. I don't know your pain. I don't know. I've never had that kind of pain. But I'm here to sit beside you as you go through this pain. And whatever I can say or do to help you move through the pain, just help us to be doers of your word, Lord, and help the words of our mouth and the meditations of our heart be acceptable to you, Lord. We thank you and praise you for who you are and that you love us unconditionally.
To you alone belongs the glory and the power and might forever and ever. Amen.